Part 2. After the war, until now. An interview with Matis Kucheida.
Mr. Kucheida, let us talk about the time right after the Second World War. First of all, how come you have information about the post-war period?
My father, Herbert Kucheida, who was director of the company at that time, wrote many letters, and I've just been reading them again. He sent some very insightful ones to his mother-in-law, Charlotte Reich, born Hensch. She was the widow of former director Fritz Reich, who had to leave Germany and died in England in 1946. She and my father were very close, by the way. But Charlotte Reich was not only important to him, she was also very well respected within the company, even though she had little technical understanding.
Were you able to find out from your father's letters what kind of entrepreneur he was?
I was surprised at the great amount of dedication with which he rebuilt the company after the war. He took a very big risk by making considerable investments. We must not forget, the company was still a general partnership then. That means the entrepreneur bears all liability with everything he has, lock, stock and barrel. But there was never doubt in my father's mind. It was part of his self-image. He and many entrepreneurs had back at that time. One should take responsibility over the company, also financially. At the same time, it was also an expression of his self-confidence. It filled him with pride to see Schmidt & Hinge succeed, and good sales really made him happy. This attitude has become quite rare nowadays. After my father died, an executor considered the risk too high and therefore decided in 1972 to change the company into a limited partnership with a limited liability company as a general partner.
When your father started out at Schmidt and Hensch, the entire German economy was at rock bottom. How did the rebuilding of the company succeed?
First of all, the employees started repairing whatever they could lay their hands on. Radio sets, cameras, for example, and anything which was broken.
Were new instruments already being developed?
No, it was only about surviving.
And then your father, Herbert Kucheida, at that time a partner in the firm, made contact with a certain Victor Graf in Gotha, who had a company for drawing instruments.
At the very first trade show after the war in Berlin, my father exhibited a drafting table. To this day, I have no idea why he did so. Drafting tables were not even part of our range of products. It was a business acquaintance who got us in touch with Victor Graf. We had the drafting table, Graf had the drafting machine. They quickly reached an agreement. Graf sold the rights of the drawing instruments to Schmidt & Hinge. By the way, he was an amateur Egyptologist and had therefore called his drawing instruments Isis. We decided to keep that name.
Did the risk of this purchase pay off?
In his letters, my father proudly writes about selling 250 pieces to one customer, a huge quantity for the beginning. Production grew rapidly. Later on, they even had to work in shifts. The drafting machines sold like hotcakes. They were not sold, but rather distributed to the customers.
Who needed this kind of equipment?
All manufacturers, car manufacturers, mechanical engineers, plant engineers, and almost all industries needed drafting machines. Thousands of jobs were filled by construction engineers and draftsmen in those days. The design of a construction was always drafted by hand. Accurate construction depended on the drafting machine's precision. It was a shock when a drastic change took place in the 90s, and this whole sector went under. Nowadays, there are hardly any draftsmen anymore.
What made this device so special?
The trick, for instance, was that the parallelogram machine that moved across the whole board by hardly applying any pressure at all, that this movement did not change the coordinate position of the drawing head. The machine could be moved back and forth with just one finger. Later in the 1960s, the so-called carriage-type drafting machines were developed, which moved the adjustable drawing head across the board in a vertical rail.
Did Schmidt and Hensch continue to refine these instruments or keep selling the same drafting machine right until production ended?
We were constantly enhancing it, offering a broad range from small drafting machines to large-scale plants measuring 12 by 4 meters. One quality feature was the fixed 15-degree angle. Mercedes set up an experiment to test the wear and tear for this fixed position. A self-locking system has been developed, and it kept holding the same position irrespectively of wear and tear. Tiny details like these were crucial to the success of the ISIS drafting machines.
At that time, your company was located on a kind of island made up of the three western sectors of Berlin. Was it even possible to purchase materials from West Germany or abroad?
The key element was to manufacture all components by ourselves. The level of in-house manufacturing was unbelievable. We even produced our own screws. At times were even other Berlin companies looking to buy screws from us when faced with a shortage. The amount of machinery for mechanical processing was huge. We had a lot of special purpose machines, such as a ground tube grinding machine, because this elaborate procedure was necessary to develop our first carriage type drafting machine, a design by industrial designer Braun Feldweg. When I was young, there was still a carpenter in charge of all the woodwork. Outsourcing of production was not common. Storage tied up a lot of capital, but the availability was more important. Delivery times were not always reliable due to the political situation, and the transit route could easily be disrupted or even come to a complete standstill.
What were the distribution arrangements?
When I started in 1982, there was not a single written contract with any of our distributors. My father did not have the need for that. One would meet at trade fairs or even visit each other. Then it was discussed what the latest product developments were like, and the sales areas were agreed upon. A general handshake was the contract.
How did it come about that a new factory was built in Köln, specifically for the production of drafting machines?
The political situation called for it. It was the time of the Berlin Wall, the Cuban Missile Crisis, the tanks facing each other at Checkpoint Charlie. It was a really tight spot. In the late 60s, our representatives in place, such as in the Netherlands and other markets, asked us, how do you continue to keep up delivery even as political tensions are that high? We need a guarantee from you. That is why part of the production was moved to Köln-Löwenich.
Why was the company so easily persuaded to produce in North Rhine-Westphalia?
Drafting machines and tables made up 80% of the company's turnover. It would have been too risky not to do so. Besides high industrial density in North Rhine-Westphalia, it allowed us a direct delivery to clients in that area. From a logistical and operational perspective, though, it didn't make real sense. On the other hand, we did need more production space because the rented area at the Berlin site in the Naumannstrasse was not sufficient anymore. Finding industrial real estate in West Berlin at that time was not easy at all.
How did Berlin and Köln work together?
Heavy parts were produced in Löwenich because their transport costs were the highest. In addition, the so-called single-column drafting tables were assembled there. And it was also where copies of all design and drawings, including those for the optical instruments, were safely locked away in a steel cabinet. So if the company would have been forced to give up its Berlin site, it would have been able to rebuild everything from scratch there. Sometimes in the evenings, a driver would often take a box of parts to the Tempelhof Airport, parts which urgently were needed the next day in the assembly line in Löwenich. It was a very time-consuming and costly issue.
Did the four-power agreement on Berlin in 1971 make things any easier?
Yes. The trucks were not opened anymore. They were sealed in West Berlin and only opened once they had reached West Germany. The whole movement of goods became easier and much more predictable.
How did you get skilled personnel when Germany was divided?
Hiring skilled workers from West Germany was difficult. On the other hand, guest workers were happy to join us. We were already very international then. We had Greek, Turks, and Iraqi employees. Most of them were not skilled workers and only received their training once they joined us. But there were also some qualified workers as well as trained technicians.
All of this took place before your time as director. You joined the company in 1982. What was the reason for this?
A number of steps led up to it. When my father knew he was going to die, he took my mother, my brother, and me along to the company and called the management together. I was only 16 years old then. Up until then, I had not even realized that one day he might not be with us anymore. At that moment, I suddenly understood. It was quite dramatic.
Were you intended to be his successor?
The plan was actually for my brother to succeed my father. He had studied economics and therefore fulfilled the professional requirements. He had also spent 1 year working at the company as a management assistant. But it turned out that this would not be successful. In the end, my grandmother decided he should not take over the company, even though it was a tough decision for her. I was still at university at that time. For me, it was out of the question to step into his shoes. I was into completely different things and had no interest whatsoever in merely earning money. I wanted to become a pediatrician. Earlier, I was studying philosophy and I wanted to become a university lecturer.
Your plans, therefore, had little to do with Schmidt and Hensch. How come you still became managing director?
It was December 1981, and the managing director, Walter Teller, was going to retire at the end of this year. He told me, either you take over the company or it goes down the drain. This caused some very restless nights for me. It might sound very morally, but I did not want to be the cause that the company, which was built up and maintained so well by four generations, would go down the drain because of me. I felt responsible for the ancestors, but also for the employees who had lived off the company for such a long time. It felt selfish to me if I would not give it at least a try, and I knew I wouldn't have been happy if I had left the company to its fate. Of course, I also knew that I could fail. The one who would know was Walter Teller. He started as an apprentice precision mechanic at Schmidt & Hensch in 1930 and had made it all the way to the managing director, working also closely with my father during that time. After my father's death, there was a triumvirate leading the company. However, this did not work out. The other two left the company and Teller became the sole managing director. So he knew what he was talking about when he told me to take overall responsibility.
How difficult was it for you to abandon your former dream of becoming a pediatrician?
The truth is, at first I did not completely give up this dream. For another year, I continued to study medicine and prepare for the final exam. Every week I flew back and forth between Berlin and Hamburg. I studied for 3 days in the hospital and managed the company for the other 3 days. Quite a balancing act emotionally too. In Berlin, I was the leader, and as a medical student in Hamburg, I was on the lowest range of the hierarchy. Nonetheless, I kept believing I could do both. That was one of the most exhausting times of my life, and it did not work on the long run. So I took a leave of absence for 2 years.
So you still did not want to be managing director for life?
Right. In those 2 years, I wanted to bring in managers from outside, and at the end of that period, hand over the operational side of the business. But I was not very well skilled in business administration. A friend of mine, a manager himself, helped me a lot during that time by increasing my awareness for business operations and management. It turned out that none of the candidates we tried working with were suitable. The commercial manager had no idea about negotiating prices. The technical manager lacked support from the employees. The recognition of someone's technical abilities is crucial in a company like ours. During this time, the firm was living off its substance. It was in such a good health, financial health condition that it could survive this too. In the end, I agreed to take over the business. Soon enough, I noticed there had been little development and too much relying on continuous success. They were resting on their laurels and they were afraid to invest.
What was your most formative experience as a young director?
I was eager for quick change, but then I realized everything needed a little time. I understood that neither human resource development nor investments in new products could be rushed. Things could not be done overnight. That was not always easy for a 30-year-old young man, as I was then.
Did you have support among the staff for the changes you were introducing?
At first, I was, of course, compared to my father because a lot of employees still remembered him. Even though he had been dead for quite a while, nearly everyone still knew him. And then Junior turns up and puts an end to the weekly beer supplies. Naturally, I did not make myself very popular this way. But soon enough, we were on respectful and loyal terms with each other. I really value the close level of communication we have amongst each other.
You had to familiarize yourself not just with business management, but also with the technical aspects.
I have always been on good terms with technology. Scientific thinking comes naturally to me, and I got into natural science during my studies as well. Even as a child, I often used to accompany my father to work and discovered many fascinating subjects there. So I had a kind of basic understanding. Nevertheless, I had to put up a lot of time into understanding all the details.
In retrospect, it was high time to introduce changes because drafting tables would soon become redundant.
I traveled to the United States for all the relevant conventions. Already the writing was on the wall. Electronics and computer science would replace the conventional drafting board. Along with two competitors who commissioned the Fraunhofer Institute for Work Organization in Stuttgart, we wanted to identify how long conventional drafting machine could survive. The Institute predicted drafting machine would become obsolete within the next 5 years. I earned then my spurs moving back the production of drafting tables from Cologne back to Berlin. I wanted to pool our sources and energies back in Berlin again.
So Schmidt and Hensch got into CAD technology.
Not quite. The three of us remaining competitors teamed up with a company in Düsseldorf and launched a joint distribution of CAD software. Quite a memorial experience. Design offices everywhere were using our drawing instruments. Our sales representatives would take a computer along to customers and spend the first 2 hours telling them what a computer actually could do. After those 2 hours, the customers tended to be too tired to hear about the actual topic. We met with a market that was completely unprepared for this technology. A computer was the work of the devil. It was all far too complicated for our customers. None of our competitors succeeded in entering this market, even though it was all there, even the dealer network. We had every kind of access to that market, and we invested a lot of money that was never recouped. The customers simply did not accept computers.
How did you react?
We brought measurement technology back to the front because that was where we had potential for development. I had already pursued this in the 80s, and I was now thinking I could use it to compensate for the changes in the market for drafting machines. But then the year 1991 and the so-called German mechanical engineering plunged into crisis. That year, the big tooling machine producers nearly went to the dogs. Many were merged. At the same time, the market for drafting machines crashed. It fell, I will never forget this, by 50% of order income every month. In 1990, we were still flooding the former GDR with drafting machines. Then, 1 year later, the entire market was dead.
How were the polarimeters doing?
The sugar industry was still eagerly buying from us. We had already built the first electronic and full automatic polarimeter in 1963, and we had been the first worldwide to do so.
And your traditional business fields became profitable again, so that they compensated for the loss of your line of drawing instruments.
To this day, our workforce has not reached the former size. We are now only half as big as we were back in the days of the drafting technology.
You have now been managing the company for more than 40 years. Has competition increased during this time?
Interestingly, most of the competition resulted from the Second World War. On his first few trips to the United States after the war, my father told a former company representative, "We are back, ready to supply you." But the wartime embargo had led to the emergence of a number of American companies, one of them managed by our representative. We are still competitors today. Apart from that, there is, of course, competition in Asia, England, and Japan. We have quite a handful of competitors.
In order to be competitive, instruments must be easy to use. Do your customers understand how they operate?
There are two types of customers. The ones we prefer are the knowledgeable ones. No need to explain to them what we do, why we do, and how we do it. They quickly evaluate if something works for them or not. And then there are customers who are just concerned with the result and they want the instruments to look nice. We come across these more and more now. It is a huge problem for all of us because of measurement errors, which can always occur, or errors due to sample taking, are not being interpreted correctly anymore. This is also due to the high fluctuation of the users today.
Not just among users, it seems the technologies are also replacing one another in rapid succession. Does it not get more and more difficult to keep up with all the technical innovations?
I'm not so much put off by technological developments as I'm fascinated by them. That is why I'm involved with the Technology Foundation and I'm a chairman of the Board of Trustees of the University of Applied Sciences. I do it partly to keep an eye on innovations which could be interested for our company. A great number of the new technologies I come across are not yet marketable, but do point in a certain direction. In general, I know today that we do not need to be scared of new things for two reasons. Usually, there are just complementary technologies improving an already existing one. In refractometry, for instance, some instruments being produced today are hardly bigger than 1 cent coin. The method itself, however, remains the same. So-called disruptive innovations are rare in measurement technology. One example of a disruptive development was the complete extinction of the drafting machines in favor of the CAD technology. What is more, the market tends to be much slower than the technology. It takes a while for the market to accept new technologies. Some customers ask us, why do you have already another new device? We have just got used to the current one. There is no need to be scared of innovation. making our own products obsolete overnight. On the other hand, you do have to stay alert, but with my staff, I'm not worried about that at all. As soon as one of us presents something new, it sets off a lively internal discussion.
How many ideas are actually put into practice and turned into a new product?
The question is difficult to answer. Our problem is that we have too many ideas and too little capacity to realize them. My people are often already at their limits when I come up with a new idea. Despite this, they often feel spurred on to get on to grips with the new ideas and show me their results.
Does this strategy pay off?
We are now back in a phase in which we are entering a stable growth phase due to the new developments, with around 10% growth per year. We are very ambitious. We are growing due to new markets and new products. We have developed new methods in sugar analysis. I've been very involved in this field. Then we built inline process refractometers. This is a completely separate development, as you cannot use a laboratory instrument. A process device has to be designed completely differently. We still see potential for expansion here, because the whole process technology means a considerable saving of the resources. Then we enter the field of density measurement. We still have a lot of ideas in the drawers, but there is not the time yet to market them. Everything remains highly exciting. We are not running out of ideas. We're constantly learning from the applications and customers, but we have to concentrate on what is feasible. That is our main task.
How long will you still be with Schmidt and Hensch?
As I find it too boring to be on the golf course all day long, I'm happy to carry on for another 10 years. Nevertheless, I do hope that one of my children will eventually take over.
Thank you very much for the interview, Mr. Kucheda.